This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, in for John Hockenberry, who's off on vacation. And lucky him, but he's not the only one. The Supreme Court officially ended its term yesterday, heading into the summer break 2013. After a remarkable couple of days, and we're going to talk about how this June of 2013 at the Supreme Court could change America for good. We'll also go to South Africa, where worldwide coverage of the declining health of Nelson Mandela has a lot of people in that country annoyed and wanting foreigners out as they prepare for what may be the final days of their beloved leader. Plus, a look at one capitalist who attributes his success, get this, not to greed and domination, but to the cloistered lifestyle of Trappist monks. You're going to want to hear that. Also, we don't know exactly when or where, but we do know this for sure, that giant asteroids are coming. It's a matter of time. Just ask the dinosaurs. NASA isn't waiting around, though. They want to protect the Earth, and they need your help. That's coming up. But first, June was a blockbuster month at the court by any measure. The court handed down four highly anticipated decisions, two impacting race and minorities in this country and two on the fate of same-sex marriage, as well as several other decisions that could have big consequences for lots of areas. The cost of your medical drugs, workplace discrimination, your rights to plead the fifth in court. Now, you've been sending us your reactions to the court's recent decisions.
My name is Chris from Columbia, South Carolina. Just wanted to say about the SCOTUS ruling on the Voting Act. It's 2013. I don't really see what the big issue is. It's not like any state's going to get away with actually trying to repress anybody's vote.
Now, Barry from Brighton, Michigan does not agree with that.
This week, the Supreme Court of the United States ran the gamut from the sublime in invalidating DOMA to the ridiculous in gutting the Voting Rights Act.
Sublime to ridiculous in Barry's view. And Jeffrey Rosen, professor of law at George Washington University and president of the National Constitution Center in Philadelphia, is going to help us figure out which it is, sublime or ridiculous. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, it's great to be here.
Well, Jeff, at first glance, you kind of get whiplash from this week at the Supreme Court. One decision upending the heart of the Voting Rights Act, sort of the legal tenet of the civil rights era. At the same time, the court recognizing that inequality for gay people, and at least for gay marriage, is unconstitutional, it's kind of hard to untangle it all.
Whiplash is a good word, and yet all the decisions are united coherently by the aggressive libertarian judicial philosophy of Justice Anthony Kennedy. This is the judge who believes, on the one hand, that gay people are entitled to equal respect and dignity, and he passionately defended their rights to equality in striking down the Voting Rights Act, but he also believes that the states are entitled to equal respect and dignity and should be free from federal intrusions onto their discretion and voting rights, and therefore was willing to invoke his vision of the colorblind Constitution to invalidate a large part of the Voting Rights Act. But for me, the great surprise of the term is why Justice Kennedy was not willing to go further in the Proposition 8 case and at the very least to declare a right of marriage equality in California, and perhaps even more broadly declare such a right across the country.
And is somebody like Justice Anthony Kennedy well aware when he issues an opinion positioned the way it was, or the majority of the court issues an opinion like that, that they are just sort of punting for 10 years the process of legalizing gay marriage in all 50 states, that they know full well this is where this is going, they just don't want to do it now?
They're well aware of the consequences of their decision. Justice Kennedy has a habit, though, of declaring a broad right in theory and then basically saying, hey, I'm not going to go and take it to its logical conclusion. In Bush v. Gore, for example, he said, this is a ticket for one train only. It's not going to create a broad right of equality for ballots, and yet Bush v. Gore has been invoked in future elections. And in the 2003 Lawrence in Texas case, when Justice Kennedy struck down sodomy laws, he said, this doesn't mean a right to gay marriage. And Justice Scalia wrote an apoplectic dissent saying, don't believe a word of it. This is going to mean the end of all morals legislation, including the end of restrictions on polygamy. And Justice Scalia repeated that prescient prediction in his dissent in the Defense of Marriage Act case today. Basically, Scalia was saying, Justice Kennedy's reasoning is so broad it has to lead eventually to a right to gay marriage. But Justice Kennedy, for perhaps pragmatic or prudential reasons, keeps denying that and saying, no, I'm not willing to go that far yet.
And also referring, as Justice Scalia did, to some of the argle bargle in some of these decisions. Glad we have you, Jeffrey Rosen, to unpack some of the argle bargle. And that was a great moment in the writing history of Antonin Scalia there.
He's given us so much pleasure over the past couple of weeks, and I loved, on the other side, his dissent in the Maryland and King DNA case, which I thought was one of the greatest Fourth Amendment dissents of all time, where he had a metaphor about our hardy forebears who cared a lot about unreasonable searches and seizures would have resisted royal intrusions into their mouths. He had this image of colonists being cheek swabbed for DNA, and he didn't like it at all.
And Scalia didn't like that, but I want to ask you about that decision. It was a sort of a decision that flew under the radar for a lot of Americans, but interesting implications in the decision on patents, that DNA cannot be patented, at least native DNA that comes out of your body. And that has major implications for biotech, but a corporate decision. There were a couple of smaller decisions this June that have a lot of impact on sort of corporations and how they can make money.
You're referring to the two DNA cases. The first one, the majority held that people can have their DNA seized on arrest and stored in a DNA database. And Justice Scalia, actually dissenting with the liberals, said that this was an unreasonable search and seizure with very large implications for NSA surveillance, for example. Then there's the gene patenting case, which you rightly described. That was a unanimous decision. That was a case where the court is saying a single company can't patent the entire genome because that would very much discourage science and medical research, but you can patent the synthetic DNA that a company has actually created on its own. So it was a kind of split the baby decision, but it very much relieved Silicon Valley and other entrepreneurs as well as academics and medical researchers who fear that the U.S. patent court has been too aggressive in allowing corporations to patent genetic material.
So what can we conclude from those two decisions in terms of this court's view of corporations? We've heard a lot of talk that we have a pro-corporate Roberts court. On the one hand, the DNA decision that you discussed seems to mean, you know, fewer patents and less profitability for biotech companies. You mentioned the other case that protects a lot of corporations in state courts. Are they kind of splitting the baby, as you said, in terms of being pro-corporatist?
You know, as to whether this is a pro-corporate court, there's been a long-standing trend of ruling in favor of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce in cases where it files briefs. A recent study by Adam Liptak of the New York Times found that this is one of the most pro-corporate courts in history, judged by the number of times that they do rule for the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, and that trend seemed to be continuing this year.
Well, before we let you go, Jeffrey Rosen, I want to step away from the law and ask you about stagecraft, somebody who watches the court as closely as you do. What do you make of the waiting game at the end of the week and what appears to be Justice John Roberts' sort of flair for the dramatic, leaving the most important decisions, at least in the minds of the public, the DOMA and Prop 8 case, not just to the last day when orders are usually issued, but the very last day of the session, and sort of leaving on what a lot of people thought was a high note? Does the Chief Justice sort of know how to keep them wanting more? What's he up to?
There's no question that Chief Justice Roberts very much wants this to be his court, and there were two very distinct places where he did that. He convinced a majority of his colleagues to dismiss the California case on jurisdictional grounds, and he also pulled off a real tour de force in convincing liberal and conservative justices to rule narrowly in the affirmative action case and not to issue the ideologically divided 5-4 decisions that many people thought. So you see his hand very much behind the scenes in fashioning the kind of narrow and bipartisan decisions that he promised to do when he first took office.
Well, we started this discussion inside the mind of Justice Anthony Kennedy, and we finished it inside the mind of Chief Justice John Roberts, and maybe that's exactly appropriate for this past June. Jeffrey Rosen, professor of law at George Washington University and president of the National Constitution Center in Philadelphia. Thanks, Jeff. Welcome back to The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick with you. Well, at the beginning of this month of June, we lived in a very different world. More than 24 Supreme Court rulings later, the law of the land looks a lot different.
I'm glad to see DOMA being struck down. This is just one more chip in a construct that needs to be taken down.
That's one listener, Sarah from Washington State. Three notable decisions this week removed voting rights protections in many southern states, increased protections for those in same-sex marriages. And here's a text we got from one listener in Texas. Two black men can marry each other, but they'll have trouble voting in the South. Well, Columbia University law professor Catherine Frank had this observation.
The language of the Supreme Court in those race cases, in effect, said constitutionally important questions of racism are no longer as pressing as they used to be. But we're able to see constitutionally pressing issues of sexual orientation-based discrimination in a new way. And that disheartens me a great deal, that the court can't see both of those forms of social injustice at the same time.
Well, now that we're on the back end of many of these Supreme Court decisions, are we a little freer in some places? What's the effect on the country? We've got to do some digestion here. Well, joining us, two old friends of The Takeaway that I'm very happy to have, our friend Ron Christie, Republican political strategist. Hi, Ron.
Hi, Todd. How are you?
I'm well, thanks. Farai Chidea, a distinguished writer in residence at New York University's Journalism Institute. Hi, Farai.
Hello.
Very good to have you both. And so many questions for the both of you as you help us sort of think about where the country is now that maybe it wasn't on June 1st. Ron Christie, you heard Catherine Frank there basically saying that the court has shown that it can only really handle one form of discrimination at a time, that discrimination that used to be so apparent to Americans is sort of not as pressing, and there's a new form of discrimination that is pressing now.
Well, I don't necessarily agree with that, Todd. I actually think that the Voting Rights Act case this week was a vindication for the rule of law and, frankly, a vindication for all of the tireless efforts of those in the civil rights movement. I think what the court effectively did was say that we have made such tremendous progress in this country since 1965 that we don't need to use the same methodology for preclearance that we had back, 48 years ago. And in fact, this country has moved forward. There are still sections in the Voting Rights Act that allow the government, allow individuals to sue for discrimination. So I think the Supreme Court has shown, frankly, not only dexterity, but maturity in arriving at that decision.
Farai Chidea, dexterity and maturity and flexibility or a different kind of attitude from the court in your view?
Yeah, I completely disagree on this. I mean, I did a piece on this case back in January, and I spoke with Natasha Korogonkor of the NAACP Legal Defense and Education Fund. And what she said, which makes a lot of sense to me, is the way to understand Section 5 is that you think of it as medicine. It makes sense for medicine to go to certain places that are unwell. And there are many places in America that are still unwell when it comes to voting rights, and a hostile attitude from local officials who don't particularly appreciate certain people voting. So to put this in context, I do think that we've put a deadline on progress when it comes to voting. You know, we think that we've reached some post-racial era, and we just haven't. And I would also point out that this particular aspect of voting rights enforcement was used in places as disparate as North Dakota and New York State, as well as in the South. So it's not just targeting one region.
Well, let's talk about states' rights for one second. While we're talking about states in the South, there were a lot of, as we heard earlier in the program, states' rights themes that ran through some of these decisions at the Supreme Court. And Ron Christie, you're a conservative. I know, or at least I assume that you believe in states' rights. And from that perspective, I wonder how you view a decision like the DOMA decision that basically, in a way, said that the federal government has to respect through its own statutes the ruling of a state like California or Vermont that has gay marriage.
Well, I am a strong proponent of states' rights, and I think, frankly, what we've seen with the Supreme Court this week with DOMA and with the Proposition 8 cases, I think that Justice Scalia said this exactly right. I think we're in a case of legal argle-bargle right now. I think the court did not want to allow a statute, DOMA, to be on the books that would have literal discrimination against people based on their sexual preference. But on the other hand, the court, in a very interesting decision authored by Chief Justice Roberts and having some of the liberal members in the court, really invalidated the standing of those who challenged DOMA. So on the federal level, they said, well, we really don't want to go towards the discrimination angle based on orientation, but we really don't want to rule on the merits in California, so we're going to kick that back to California. I think that's going to lead to more legal misinformation and misunderstanding than clarity from the court.
Farai Chidea, Antonin Scalia did use that term argle-bargle, and Ron Christie's right that the Supreme Court, instead of ruling on equality in California, did punt. Do those things take anything away from these decisions for you?
Oh, not at all, because California very clearly is going to implement marriage equality. And if you look, for example, at Nate Silver's blog, Ron and I are both at the Aspen Ideas Festival, and Nate Silver spoke last night, but he just wrote, same-sex marriage availability set to double in a one-year span. And in fact, we've already seen between last November and now, it went from 6 states and D.C. that had same-sex marriage to 12 states and D.C. California is going to roll out that's going to mean about 30% of Americans by population numbers will have access to marriage equality. So this is a fast, hard shift in America. And of course, there'll be court cases, but, you know, it's over. It's done. Wrap it.
Well, Farai, my last question for you. We've talked about, of course, DOMA, Proposition 8, voting rights. Those are the big decisions. So many other decisions in June, smaller ones, on gene patenting, on adoption, on even on pharmaceutical companies. We don't have to get into all of the details of this case, but do you have your head around how the country is different now at getting towards July 1st than it was a month ago?
Well, I think that I like to think of America as a world where it thinks of itself as post everything, post racial, you know, post bias, and we're not. But that said, we are doing a dang fine job of evolving. It's not always perfect. I disagree with the voting rights decision, but we are evolving overall in a positive decision. And just on the gene patenting thing, I completely agree with the ruling that you shouldn't be able to patent the human genome. I mean, does that mean I'd be owned by somebody? What?
Well, Ron Christie, you've written about how this country is progressing on race. You've written how Barack Obama is holding us back in your books. Your assessment, where we are at the end of June here?
I actually think I agree with my friend Farai here. I do think that America is making remarkable progress in trying to be post-racial. I think the Voting Rights Act case, even though Farai and I disagree on this, is a step in the strong right direction. I do ultimately believe that individual states are going to look at the Supreme Court's ruling and enact statutes on single-sex marriage. And I think that, frankly, we need to start looking at what binds us together as Americans rather than what drives us apart. And I think that's where we are here at this point in 2013.
And you are both there at about 8,000 feet at the Aspen Ideas Festival. That's Ron Christie, Republican political strategist, and Farai Chidea, a distinguished writer in residence at New York University's Journalism Institute. Old friends of The Takeaway and right now in the mountains where I'm from. Guys, thanks for joining us.
Always a pleasure, Todd.
Great to have you. And we're hearing from you, of course, on this major week at the Supreme Court. A listener from Ardsley, New York, texts us this. The DOMA and Prop 8 decisions are inevitably baby steps towards equality for all. It makes me a little less ashamed, maybe even proud to call myself an American. And Michael from Seattle writes us this. Today is a good day for all Americans. We are one step closer to those ideals of the ideals of our founders in 1789. Well, what do you think about the Supreme Court's decision this week? We've had so much discussion about the decision, large cases and small, and it's important for us on this show to hear from you. The Supreme Court doesn't hear directly from you, but we sure want to. Give us a call at 8778-MY-TAKE. You can tweet us at The Takeaway. You can always leave your comments on our website. That's thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick, sitting in for John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.